Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida lawmakers are on the verge of approving changes to the state's death penalty system, but some warn deeper problems remain.
This bill is required to bring our procedures within constitutional requirements right now, but will not address those other issues.
Also this week, academics are giving Florida lawmakers a mostly optimistic vision of a future where cars drive themselves and the Gulf Stream powers our homes.
This is different. What you are hearing, no one else really in the United States, certainly in Florida, is hearing before today. This potential eclipses every other renewable energy source.
We'll also learn about what some experts think is the futility of the conventional fight against Florida's explosion of invasive species and discover that a new license plate bearing the name of a conservative icon is also finding favor among some liberals. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Florida lawmakers seem likely to approve unanimous jury sentences for death penalty cases in the opening weeks of this year's legislative session, but Nick Evans reports some warn there could be another crisis around the corner.
Florida's legislative session doesn't officially begin until March 7th, but death penalty fixes are just days away from their final committee stops in the House and Senate. The measures are identical in purpose and narrow in scope. Everything about the current law stays the same. But 12 rather than 10 jurors will have to agree before recommending a death sentence.
The bill changes the requirement for a jury recommendation from 10 to 2, currently in the statute, to unanimous. The goal of the bill is to have a working death penalty statute in the state of Florida.
Palm Harbor Republican Representative Chris Sprouls is sponsoring the measure in the House. The move to unanimity is receiving plaudits from activists and attorneys historically critical of the state's capital punishment scheme. Still, Polk County Public Defender Rex Dimmick warns it would be a mistake to assume the system is on firm footing.
If Florida is to continue to have a death penalty, comprehensive reform is needed. This bill is required to bring our procedures within constitutional requirements right now, but will not address those other issues.
Dimmick points to the state's extensive list of aggravating factors, elements of a crime necessary to raise a sentence from life to death. The wide array of factors might be susceptible to legal challenge because it may not adequately narrow the field of defendants eligible for the death penalty. And then there's the question of retroactivity.
Because now you've got an equal protection argument. Those who were sentenced before 2002 do not get relief. Those who were sentenced after 2002 do get relief. So it's raised more litigation. It has not brought finality.
In the Senate, Democrat Randolph Bracey made a half-hearted attempt to address the issue. He offered an amendment stating it was the legislature's intent for the unanimous standard to apply to every person on death row. He quickly withdrew the amendment for lack of votes. But even if those problems lie far down the road, Michael Radelet warns the deluge of new proceedings for cases after the cutoff will still stress the criminal justice system.
There have been 201 people sentenced to death since that date. Of those, we know of at least 134 where the judges sentenced the guy to death after juries had returned a non-unanimous verdict.
Radelet is a sociology professor in Colorado who's been cataloging capital cases since 1979. He teamed up with New Orleans capital defense attorney Ben Cohen to analyze how many inmates might get new hearings. A state office responsible for tracking cases lost funding in 2011. They warn their data are incomplete, and 134 is the minimum likely to receive new hearings. And like Dimmig, Cohen criticizes the court's cutoff.
There's people who were raising this claim, who were pointing out the problem in the late 1980s and the 1990s. And because they were too early, the courts aren't granting them relief. It seems both arbitrary and cruel.
Representative Sprouls, a lawyer by training, doesn't like the partial retroactivity ruling either. But he says it's not the legislature's place to change the court's decision. The House measure is set for its final committee stop Tuesday. The Senate version goes before its final panel a day later. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
In the midst of perennial debates over abortion and gun control, Florida lawmakers paused briefly this week to contemplate a nearly utopian future, one where cars drive themselves and the mighty Gulf Stream provides most of our energy needs. Jim Ash has the look ahead.
As lobbyists for local waste-to-energy plants lined up to complain about monopoly power companies, House Energy Subcommittee Chairwoman Kathleen Peters nervously looked at the clock.
We have another presentation that I'm really excited about, and it's about the future, possible future of something different that we haven't heard about. So I'm going to ask if you come up to be concise and not repeat what we've already heard, if that's okay.
Moments later, Lake Worth lobbyist Richard Penske stepped to the microphone to make a major announcement. Florida Atlantic University researchers have just reached a deal with the city's municipal power plant to begin testing methods for harnessing the Gulf Stream.
This is different. What you are hearing, no one else really in the United States, certainly in Florida, is hearing before today. This potential eclipses every other renewable energy source.
7 years ago, FAU became home to the Southeast National Marine Renewable Energy Center. Center Director Susan Kemp told the committee a 2013 Georgia Tech study shows the Gulf Stream is packing a 45 terawatt hour per year punch.
That is about the same amount of energy for the portfolio in Florida of coal. If you look at further, that is about 4 to 6 gigawatts. And in 4 to 6 gigawatts in context, Turkey Point is about 1.4 gigawatts, and St. Lucie is about 2 gigawatts.
The upside of marine renewable energy is that it's virtually pollution-free, emitting no greenhouse gases and generating zero nuclear waste. The downside is the potential harm to marine life. Kemp told lawmakers her center is studying regulatory regimes to soften the ecological impact. The center began testing marine turbines off of Palm Beach County in 2014. This year, center officials are applying for a $350,000 state energy grant to cover the cost of wiring the Lake Worth power plant to the testing site. Also this week, Florida State University urban planning professor Tim Chapin appeared in front of a Senate Transportation Committee to describe a revolution driven by so-called autonomous vehicles.
The short story here is that change is coming to Florida, to the United States, to the world in the form of autonomous vehicles, and we believe that this is going to be a truly transformational technology.
Chapin and FSU planner-in-residence Lindsay Stevens told the panel they expect half of all cars on the road to be driverless by 2040 and a full transition by 2060. They described a future where seniors don't have to surrender their mobility when they give up the car keys, and where robot cars chauffeur kids to after-school activities. Stevens said driving lanes will narrow and bike lanes will sprout, and parking lots will no longer be needed.
If you think about a typical mall with a 100-year parking event, if you will, or the parking that even doesn't fill up on Thanksgiving or the day after Thanksgiving, these are really holding areas we see for redevelopment opportunities moving forward.
Experts expect a dramatic reduction in the nation's 30,000 annual traffic fatalities. But Stevens says not all changes may be welcome. Driverless cars will eliminate the hassles of the daily commute, but she said that could also encourage urban sprawl. John Terwilliger, an industry attorney with Gunster in South Florida, says Florida is the most welcoming state in the nation when it comes to autonomous vehicles.
In Florida, there really are very few legal barriers. The biggest factor with an autonomous vehicle is just that it has to follow the traffic safety laws and be able to drive under the same rules as everyone else.
Still on the horizon, experts say, are big questions about automobile insurance and civil liability. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida lawmakers don't usually reveal their wish list for local spending projects this early in the year, but while the House changed its rules this year so that projects are filed as separate bills, the Senate did not.
What remains to be seen is how does this match up with Senate requests that don't have the same rules.
The state of Florida loses a crucial round in its decades-long battle with Georgia over water.
So I think there's a lot of reason for the Corps to go back to the drawing board.
Lawmakers are looking for a solution for when signatures don't match on mail-in ballots.
I remember 2001 when I first did my driver's license, and I scribbled something on that thing, and You know, here we are, you know, 17 years later, I have no idea what I did.
Has Florida's invasive species problems become so big that even trying to do something about them has become an exercise in futility?
Don't let there be another Burmese python. Don't let there be another lionfish. Let those be the last problems like that that we have to solve.
And a new specialty license plate meant to honor a former U.S. president will also go toward helping Floridians with Alzheimer's. As part of assembling Florida's budget for the next fiscal year, legislators are pushing local pet projects. But Sarah Mueller reports there's a new vetting process for House members this year intended to bring more transparency to the process.
More than 60 kids and their instruments are crammed into a classroom at Florida State University Schools. Sometimes space is so tight at the charter school that the orchestra practices outside in a field. Director Stacey Chambers says the school needs another building, and she's hoping Tallahassee Representative Lorraine Osley can get $20 million from the legislature so she can build one on that field.
This is the elementary wing, all right? So you're looking at it being on this corner. They have a courtyard so they can enter and exit through the courtyard. They wouldn't even have to come out here. You could just fence it off.
The building is just one of more than 300 projects the Florida House members want money for, adding up to a total of $708 million. House Speaker Richard Corcoran changed the rules for the House this year by mandating all proposed one-time spending projects be filed as separate bills. Passing laws has famously been compared to making sausages, a process that can turn some people's stomachs. Corcoran says he hopes to turn a light on so-called member projects to avoid the tradition lawmakers have of adding more spending to the budget late in the appropriations process. Corcoran says the move will weed out projects, he says, would just waste money. But what's waste and what's vital is in the eye of the beholder.
And so what we've said all along, which is real, is that what we have in this state is a spending problem. If we could take out some of those pork barrel projects, if we can rein in and then do an assessment of what really is working, then we'll have that money to put things to where they really transform people's lives.
Representative Osley praises Corcoran for adding more transparency.
At the outset of the session, we know, you know, what projects have been requested, and they'll go through the process. What remains to be seen is how does this match up with Senate requests that don't have the same rules.
The most expensive project is sponsored by Sebring Republican Kerry Pigman. He's asking for $62 million to tear down and replace an aging high school. Meanwhile, Deltona's David Santiago's ask is $25,000 for an elementary school science lab. Pasco County Sheriff's Office also has a science-related request. It wants $4.3 million to build a statewide forensic training center. Assistant Executive Director Chase Daniels says the facility could help solve cold cases.
We believe there are over 16,000 of these cold cases in Florida that we think we could help solve, as well as also training with Dr. Kimberly, learning the latest and the greatest on forensic sciences.
Tallahassee Representative Raymond Alexander says he intends to convince the House Speaker that the more than $60 million in projects he's asking for are worth the investment.
Our focus is to laser in on our priorities and make sure that we are taking very seriously our responsibility to articulate the value of these particular projects, and we're going to do everything necessary to ensure that we communicate that to members and get it through the process.
While the House is showing how the sausage gets made, the Senate's keeping its rules the same. It doesn't require projects to be filed as separate bills. Senate Appropriations Chairman Jack Latvala says there's different ways of achieving transparency. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
A legal fight between the states of Florida and Georgia over water use has been tilted strongly in Georgia's favor. As Lynn Hatter reports, that development is sparking a closer look at the policies of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which oversees water resources in the multi-river system.
Florida and Georgia have been fighting over water use in the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint River system for more than 30 years. Georgia says it needs more water upstream to meet the state's growing population and agricultural demands. Florida says keeping more water upstream hurts its Apalachicola Bay, where seafood production is the dominant industry. And Apalachicola has felt the pain.
5 years ago, I'd give it a B.
What letter grade would you give it today?
On the oyster situation?
Mm-hmm.
An F. Ooh. Can't help but to be an F.
TJ Ward's family runs 13 Mile Seafood in Apalachicola, and they've been in the oyster industry for more than 50 years. But that industry has collapsed over the past several years due to droughts and decreased water flow in the Apalachicola Basin. Special Master Ralph Lancaster Jr. recently ruled that Florida could not prove whether those low flows are a result of Georgia's actions upstream, climate changes, or policies by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which manages the AFC Basin. But Lancaster's ruling also seemed to suggest Florida should take issue with the Corps, says Apalachicola Riverkeeper Dan Tonsmeyer.
So I think there's a lot of reason for the Corps to go back to the drawing board. And I hope it's not through litigation, because we see that all the money and time that was spent on this litigation.
The draft ride has certain language in there that's not prepared as of yet.
Right.
Army Corps officials presented a revamped water plan in a November 2015 town hall meeting in Apalachicola. The public comment period recently closed, and that plan is now pending final review. It further increases the amount of water Georgia can withhold upstream, and that's bad news for Apalachicola Bay, says Tonsmeyer.
But I certainly think that if the Corps goes forward with its alternative recommendation that there is should be some serious focus on looking at checking that, because of the inequity of their management and the lack of their consideration of the needs of all those in the basin.
Special Master Lancaster's ruling in favor of Georgia is now heading to the U.S. Supreme Court. But now Florida congressmen are trying to hammer out another solution. U.S. Senator Bill Nelson is filing a bill requiring the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to increase water flow into Apalachicola Bay and River. And North Florida Congressman Neil Dunn is pushing the Corps to put a pause on its plans for Georgia until the agency meets with Florida officials. Dunn is also proposing a resolution to block the agency's new rules. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Lawmakers are looking into a plan to ensure more of Florida's vote-by-mail ballots are counted, as we hear from Regan McCarthy.
During the 2016 general election, nearly 3 million people turned in their votes through a vote-by-mail ballot. The option is popular in Florida, but can also be problematic.
So these are the vote-by-mail ones. We're making easy work for you here. There's none that were determined to have a clear intent.
During an election, county canvassing boards like this one review hundreds of ballots. In some cases, it's because a vote is unclear or because the machine couldn't read the ballot. In other cases, it's because there's a question about whether the signature on the mail-in ballot matches the signature provided when a person registered to vote.
It was a difficult thing to try to match up some of the signatures with the signatures on the ballots, and it spent an awful lot of time.
That's Auburndale Republican Representative Neil Combe. He says he spent several years working on his county's canvassing board and often wished for a better solution.
Back then, thought there should be some way, a process for notifying people to let them know that these signatures don't match.
And Coral Gables Republican Representative Daisy Baez agrees. She says many people may not pay close attention to their signatures.
I remember 2001 when I first did my driver's license, and I scribbled something on that thing. And, you know, here we are, you know, 17 years later, I have no idea what I did. So that discrepancy shouldn't prevent my vote from counting.
Now lawmakers are looking into a plan to address that.
HB 105 puts into statute that the local supervisor of elections must offer a voter the chance to cure a ballot that was rejected due to a mismatched signature by signing an affidavit attributing to the validity of the ballot by 5 p.m. on the day before Election Day.
That's Hollywood Democratic Representative Evan Jenny. He's co-sponsoring the bill with Tampa Democratic Representative Janet Cruz. During a meeting of the House Oversight and Administration Subcommittee, lawmakers amended the bill so that voters are contacted with enough time to solve the problem if their ballots are rejected. The amendment also expands the way an election supervisor could verify a voter's identity. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida is a prime breeding ground for invasive species that can threaten the state's ecology and economy. For every lionfish or Burmese python that's captured, thousands remain free. And the sheer scope of the problem is pushing some lawmakers to ask how much of a difference state funding actually makes. Kate Payne reports.
From spiny lionfish to the kudzu vine to lizards called tegus, invasive species are making their mark on Florida. Because they have no natural predators, non-native species can quickly dominate their new environment. One of the most famous Florida cases is the Burmese python. They can be more than 17 feet long and have been known to eat deer and even alligators. And conservationists are taking some non-conventional steps to combat them. The state now hosts the Python Challenge, a sort of open season on the reptiles.
Conserving our native wildlife is the driving force behind the Python Challenge. Remember, you can help.
Apart from hunting seasons and fishing tournaments, biologists from multiple state agencies and universities are targeting each species individually. But all of these efforts are barely scratching the surface. According to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, a single lionfish can produce up to 2 million eggs a year. That stat struck Republican Representative Chuck Clemens of Jonesville at a recent committee meeting.
All of our efforts last year netted 110 or 120,000 lionfish with all the roundups and the rodeos and the different things like that. So if we are 20 times more effective than we were last year, that would equate, based upon my arithmetic, to the offspring of one lionfish. Is that correct?
Thomas Eason oversees conservation at FWC, and he admits the problem does seem insurmountable. He recently made his pitch to state lawmakers.
This is a bigger problem than FWC can do. We really appreciate your interest in this issue and are here to work with you on how we can do more. We're doing good things, but to be honest, we are still clawing to figure out how to start holding even or trying to start winning this battle with some of these invasive species.
But some legislators are questioning if the state is getting a strong return on its investment. Republican Ben Albritton of Bartow oversees the House Agriculture and Natural Resources budget. And he's singling out land management and invasive species programs for special scrutiny.
I would lay that up as an opportunity to potentially save some money, but I would also ask our agencies to give us some direction on what kind of progress has that funding provided us. And if that funding was reduced, then what are our expectations?
University of Florida biologist Frank Mazzotti specializes in invasive reptiles and amphibians. He says the numbers can seem overwhelming, but he says conservationists have overcome similar odds before in the fight against a tree called Melaleuca.
And 20 years ago, you would have been sitting there and saying, I'm pressing you on this. Melaleuca produces millions of seeds. What are we going to do about it? And the answer is that we studied it, we came up with biological control, we invested resources in solving the problem, and we solved the problem.
But Mazzotti says the best way to combat invasive species is prevention.
You want your best return on investment? Focus on early detection and rapid response. Don't let there be another Burmese python. Don't let there be another lionfish.
The risks associated with invasive species seem to strike a chord with lawmakers at a recent workshop, including Republican Ben Albritton, who initially seemed skeptical. But it's still up to conservationists to defend their funding. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, there are more than 120 specialty license plates in Florida, and some state lawmakers are hoping to add several more to that list. As Sasha Cordner reports, it includes a President Ronald Reagan license plate that will also go toward helping fight the disease he had in the latter years of his life.
Speaking years ago on Larry King Live, Nancy Reagan recalled the hardest part of taking care of her husband, former President Ronald Reagan, who was later diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
It's sad to see somebody you love and have been married for so long, and you can't share memories. That's the sad part.
There is speculation that Ronald Reagan may have had the disease during his presidency, but Reagan himself disclosed his illness a few years after his two terms in the 1990s. That admission helped shed light on the disease. With an ever-growing older population, Florida has one of the highest incidents of Alzheimer's disease in the nation. A form of dementia, it can cause memory loss and confusion. And Loxahatchee Republican Representative Rick Roth knows firsthand what it's like to help care for someone with the disease.
My wife chose to help her aunt, that had just turned 89 years old, was living in Columbus, Ohio, is now living in our home in South Florida. She's 89 years old and she has dementia. And example, she's lived in Florida now for 5 months. She still thinks she's in Ohio.
That's why Roth says his bill creating a license plate featuring President Ronald Reagan is important.
This is a license, specialty license plate bill. It's honoring our 40th president. 50% of the proceeds will go to for Alzheimer's disease. The money will be administrated by the Ronald Reagan Centennial Incorporated, which is a nonprofit organization that set up shop in Orlando, Florida a year ago, and they will administer the funds.
The bill hits close to home with St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Wenge Newton.
President Reagan, Alzheimer's is a terrible thing. I saw when it was taking him over, I recently lost my wife's mom to Alzheimer's, and it was a terrible situation. I mean, to see the And when the mom got very, very ill with it, she couldn't even recognize her daughter. It was heart-wrenching. But I'm glad to see that at least half of it's going to go to ongoing research, and that's important.
And it also strikes a chord with Republican Representative Brad Drake.
This is a very serious issue, and I don't think anybody on this committee doesn't have someone very close to them or know someone in their family that probably at some point in time struggled with this disease. And my grandmother suffered from Alzheimer's, and it's very sad. So I commend you for doing this. I don't know why we have not done this thus far, but I appreciate you bringing that forward.
While the bill recently passed its first House committee, its Senate companion has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us again next week for more reports from the State Capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.